Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone requires assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to our Cancer Care Workshop today, update from the 2015 American Society of Hematology, or ASH, annual meeting. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as blood cancer organizations. And we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today. We have over 860 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Nepal, the Netherlands, Serbia, Spain, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program has been supported by a number of industries. I want to say that today's program was supported by a grant from Genentech, Gilead, Novartis Oncology, Jazz Pharmaceuticals, Takeda Oncology, an educational donation provided by Onyx Pharmaceuticals, an Amgen subsidiary, and an unrestricted educational grant from Insight. I really want to thank this corporate support and this LE partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor. Dr. O'Connor is Professor of Medicine and Experimental Therapeutics, Director, Center for Lymphoid Malignancies, Department of Medicine. He's Co-Director, Program of Lymphoid Development and Malignancies, the Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center, Columbia University Medical Center, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. O'Connor is going to address the purpose of the American Society of Hematology ASH annual meeting, an overview of blood cancers and lymphoma treatment and research updates from ASH, as well as clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and thank you for such a formidable task to cover all of this inside of 10 minutes, but I will do my best. So thank you, everybody, and thank you for taking the time out of your schedules to listen to us today. I think there's never been a more exciting time in the history of medical oncology, cancer research, and certainly not in the history of blood cancer research as we're living through at the moment. And each year, investigators, nurses, doctors, scientists from all over the world come together in the United States, always the first weekend in December, to come together and share their insights and experiences on new ideas and new data that are developing in various research efforts for patients with blood cancers. And ASH, the American Society of Hematology, this year I think there were over 25,000 people from all over the world, Asia, North America, and Europe, sharing 3 or 4 days together, sharing and talking about a lot of very exciting data. And today I'll touch on some of those, and you'll hear from my colleagues who will touch on some data in their respective areas. But it is a very, very exciting time as we look to really change the natural history of all of these diseases. It is remarkable to me, as somebody who's been doing this a while, that we're now changing the natural history of many different types of cancer within our generation. So within the time that I started and Mike started when we were training together, we've watched many of these diseases go from diseases with poor outcomes to diseases now with amazingly favorable outcomes. And that's really a product of a lot of research. And I'll end by touching on the importance of clinical trials and how that really accelerates our understanding and implementation of the latest discoveries. So just to start off, blood cancers are really a very, very, very diverse group of diseases. When you say the word cancer or you say the word lymphoma, to guys like me and those on this panel, it's a very vague term and we don't probably know what you're talking about. There are 70 kinds of lymphoma, and even within separate lymphomas, there are many, many subsets of disease. And as our biological understanding of these diseases becomes more sophisticated, we tend to be splitting more in terms of trying to identify different prognostic or biologic entities of these diseases. Where do blood cancers come from? Well, each of my associates will talk about it in the context of their focus, but in essence, you all recognize that in the bone marrow, you have perhaps one of the most interesting cells in the body, and that's the hematopoietic stem cell. This cell has the amazing capability of producing any other kind of cell that your body needs. Those major blood cells include white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets. So in general, a malignancy or cancer can derive from any kind of cell in the body. So there are malignancies of white blood cells, red blood cells, and various platelet precursors that all fall under this broader rubric of blood cancers. When we talk about lymphoma or we talk about certain kinds of leukemia or myeloma, we're fundamentally talking about malignancies derived from white blood cells. In general, we break up white blood cells into either being lymphoid or myeloid, and all of these different cells have many different functions in the immune system. They play a whole host of roles in terms of helping you fight off infection. If we just look at the lymphomas, which will be my topic for the moment, there are over 70 kinds of lymphoma. So a very, very diverse group of diseases. And when we think about where those diseases come from, when we talk about those white blood cells, which we call lymphocytes, there are actually three different kinds of lymphocytes, B lymphocytes, T lymphocytes, and NK lymphocytes. And each one of those different kinds of cells can give rise to a very unique spectrum of malignant disease or lymphoid neoplasms. The lymphomas, without boring you to tears on all 70 subtypes, come in two broad flavors, what we call indolent and what we call aggressive. And those diseases are managed in radically different ways. Aggressive diseases typically require combination chemotherapy and can be curable. The indolent diseases typically can be monitored in very conservative ways, are often considered not curable, but that's not a bad thing these days. Not curable does not mean not manageable, but most of those diseases wind up being very manageable. So when we think about some of those subtypes of lymphoma and the big advances that have developed over the last year, I'm just going to touch on two or three very high-flying concepts and very broad data sets that have emerged, which I think are going to totally change how we approach the standard of care for these diseases. And there's no doubt that probably one of the greatest success stories in lymphoma therapy over the last 30 years has been in the care of patients with Hodgkin lymphoma, and I'll go out on a limb. Today, we probably cure 75% of patients with Hodgkin lymphoma, and I think before I retire, we're probably going to be well north of 90% to 95%. The pace of discovery, the pace of these new drugs is changing the natural history of these diseases. And probably the one drug over the last couple of years that has really garnished a lot of attention and produced a lot of enthusiasm are what we call the checkpoint inhibitors. These drugs fall under this larger class of drugs called PD-1 or PD-L1 drugs. Keytruda and pembrolizumab are two examples. And these drugs, in essence, break the tolerance or help your immune system re-identify what those malignant cells are. You might reasonably presume that somebody diagnosed with a malignancy of any type has an immune system that's sort of gone to sleep in terms of its ability to identify and eradicate that disease at early stages. What these drugs really seem to be able to do is re-educate your immune system to fight those diseases, and the data that's being produced to date is remarkable. We use these drugs a lot in my practice here at Columbia University, and we've treated many, many patients who have relapsed disease after conventional chemotherapy and after autologous stem cell transplant. Many of these patients may have seen 10, 12, 15 different drugs. And these new PD-1 type antibodies are actually producing remarkable remissions, complete remissions in many of these patients. And in some cases, that's just providing disease control. In other, it's providing a bridge to other forms of transplant, like allogeneic stem cell transplant. But one of the major areas of development is how to use those drugs in the earlier upfront settings and asking the question, is it possible that we could one day supplant conventional chemotherapy with many of these new drugs like PD-1? And you've heard me speak about brentuximab and other agents in this disease in the past. But you might imagine that a shift toward less genotoxic or less DNA damaging drugs to more of these immunomodulatory drugs can be a big deal. A regimen that's being developed, actually we started to develop a regimen of brentuximab, vedotin plus bendamustine, and that is an example of a regimen that's now been used for patients who relapse after ABVD. The standard therapy, for example, for patients with Hodgkin's disease who relapse after ABVD is ICE. ICE chemotherapy is a pretty good therapy. It's a standard of care around the world. But ICE is not perfect. It produces an overall response rate of about 50% and a CR rate of about 25%. And when you're treating patients who've immediately relapsed after ABVD with Hodgkin's disease, the most important thing you want out of a therapy is get patients to a complete response so you can do a peripheral blood stem cell transplant and cure the disease. So you can see getting 25% with ICE is good, but it's not perfect. Some of the data that was presented by our group and Ann LeCase from Boston show that the combination of brentuximab and bendamustine in patients relapsing after ABVD, that response rate now is over 90%, and that CR rate has jumped from 25 to 80%, meaning theoretically we'll get more patients to curative transplant, and I think it is either now or very soon will be the new standard of care for patients with relapsed disease. Hodgkin's disease is an area where there are major advances, and I think that we're changing that natural history as we speak. I think another area where we've seen a lot of advances is in the area of CLL, or chronic lymphocytic leukemia. This is a disease that typically afflicts people who are older, usually in their 70s, and there was really interesting data from ASH on the RESONATE study, which looked to try and integrate a new drug, ibrutinib, and compare it to a conventional chemotherapy drug called chlorambucil. And this study, the RESONATE study, focused on untreated patients with CLL in the frontline setting. And it actually demonstrated very highly significant advantages for the use of ibrutinib. Ibrutinib is not conventional chemotherapy. It's a highly targeted drug for a unique protein that drives the growth of CLL cells, and there's an expectation that the ability to use many of these newer drugs, I'm sure you've heard about ibrutinib, idelalisib, and others, in the relapse setting, the focus now is try to bring these drugs, these new drugs that are oral, well-tolerated, try to use them in the frontline setting, and they may be able to change that natural history. Another drug that sort of fits that bill is called venetoclax. It's a BCL2-targeted drug. This has been one of those areas in cancer research where we've been looking for drugs to sort of target the cancer cell's ability to survive when it shouldn't. And venetoclax has, there was data presented at ASH in patients with relapsed or refractory CLL, where venetoclax, when you look at patients with CLL and you look at their minimal residual disease by molecular methods, that we can identify patients who become MRD positive, meaning we don't see that disease even when we search with our most sensitive methods possible. And that's now beginning to suggest that maybe with these potent drugs, we can produce amazing deep remissions in a relatively short period of time, stop the therapy, and then see what happens rather than trying to treat patients for extended periods of time. In the case of other lymphomas, venetoclax, which sort of makes it easier for tumor cells to die when they're exposed to other agents, there's data looking at it in indolent lymphomas with brentuximab and rituxan. And again, that seems to suggest that adding some of these newer drugs to even some of the conventional regimens can really increase the efficacy of some of our conventional therapies. Lastly, T-cell lymphoma, an area we spend a lot of time on here at Columbia, a lot of exciting advances. This probably represents one of the last bastions in lymphoma research where we need to make better advances, more significant advances, and we haven't over the previous 30 years or so. But now the development of many new drugs, we put them under this broader class of epigenetic drugs, are not chemotherapy, and these drugs seem to have very interesting activity, really almost exclusively in patients with T-cell lymphoma. And there were a lot of data really trying to look at how to optimize these new drugs in the upfront care of patients with T-cell lymphoma, as well as in patients with relapsed disease. I'll conclude by telling you that there's no advance we make in medical oncology, and no advance you'll hear from my colleagues in a moment, that we don't make without using clinical trials. Many patients today, I still think there's a very high level of skepticism when it comes to patients thinking about clinical trials, like we're trying to dupe patients into doing some big grand experiment without being transparent. And nothing could be further from the truth. Clinical trials are the mechanism we use to try to identify new standards of care. If every patient today said we won't go on a clinical trial, then you can bank on the fact that we won't have new therapies for you in the future and we won't know how to use them. Clinical trials are an important tool, and they're oftentimes an important way to access drugs that you otherwise couldn't get. So every therapy we use in oncology has been studied, has been vetted on a clinical trial, and every clinical trial is monitored very, very closely with respect to technical and ethical criteria from the government, from the FDA, and from the institution. So where possible, I would always ask the doctor, don't wait for them to ask you, are there any clinical trials I can participate in so we can really move the needle in terms of accelerating the implementation of these new therapies for every patient with a blood cancer. So with that, I'll turn it back to Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Connor. That was outstanding and really just so informative. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is lead of myeloproliferative neoplasms program, attending physician leukemia service, member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. Dr. Morrow is going to address an overview of leukemia, leukemia treatment, and research updates from ASH, and key questions to ask your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you all for joining us on the call today. And Owen O'Connor just led us off with a fantastic overview, and you know, I'd like to echo some of the things Owen said, that when Owen and I would train together, which was at a time when cell phones were not widely used and there was no electronic medical record, we used to think more about what we call chemotherapy as the dangerous and more heavy with side effect type of medications that people generally associate with cancer treatment. You know, I'm proud to say, as I give you an overview of leukemia and some of the advances in leukemia from the ASH meeting in 2015, that almost none of the things, or really none of the things I'm going to speak about are in that category. So perhaps first I wanted to just say, you know, how do we define chemotherapy, and where are we with chemotherapy in 2015? The word chemotherapy obviously is frightening. It's the second most frightening word after the diagnosis of cancer. But I want to reassure you that between the advances in our understanding of what drives cancer, our understanding of how to develop medications, how to make them, if you will, leaner and somewhat meaner against the cancer, but not so much meaner against patients, we really changed the way that word should look. You know, chemotherapy historically was divided into drugs that we think of as cytotoxic killing cells and often hurting healthy cells or healthy tissue alongside the cancer cells. And then a separate category were drugs called targeted therapy, things like antibodies that work through our immune system's mechanisms, or hormones like in breast cancer and prostate cancer, which, you know, could obviously cause side effects and cause many different problems in them themselves, but they weren't what people thought of as chemotherapy. Our world in cancer therapy now is really being increasingly populated, and hopefully someday will be dominated or almost completely taken over by what I would say are new chemotherapy drugs, which are still chemotherapy chemicals that treat cancer cells or target cancer cells, but they're much more smart than therapy we ever had before. When we think about leukemia, and just to help you understand that, and I think many of you know, but we divide leukemia into four broad categories. There's actually a fifth type of leukemia, which is a rare leukemia called hairy cell leukemia, which is a little bit closer to CLL or lymphoid type of a blood condition or blood cancer, and it's just called that because the cells under the microscope look a certain way. But we generally divide leukemia into the way that the condition behaves and affects patients. Is it something that's what we call acute, where symptoms and problems can develop quickly, and probably at the scientific level, the cells have really not matured very much. They're cells that are very primitive, very immature, generally don't function. So they, I describe them as blanks. They don't do the things they're supposed to do. Whereas in chronic leukemias, the cells are moving at a different pace. They divide and grow differently. The side effects and problems that occur are generally slower, and the condition itself has a different threat or risk and can be long-lasting, something that someone can live for many years, sometimes even untreated, as Dr. O'Connor mentioned, CLL, and how we have great advances. But many patients don't need treatment right away. So acute leukemia generally does need treatment right away. Chronic leukemias often do, not always, and it depends on the type. We divide them by generally in broad categories of cells that we're talking about, either something related to lymphocytes, which are T cells, B cells that are involved in our immune system with regards to viral infections and antibodies and immunity, and myeloid cells, which are involved in the things that would keep you from getting a bacteria into your system or to fight something that comes quickly and tries to set up that type of infection. We treat them all depending on their underlying mechanism and the molecular basis. And as I said earlier, our chemotherapy has really changed. So, it's possible with a targeted therapy to have something that's selective, has very few side effects, can be highly effective, and potentially could be curable. And one example will be what I'll finish with, which is how we're doing in the disease I treat most often, which is CML, a chronic myeloid leukemia, where targeted therapy, which is still chemotherapy, has proven to be highly effective and now potentially functionally cure patients with CML. But let me start with AML. AML has been a condition that has been always serious and always very dangerous and threatening to patients, something that strikes adults and children, or it can happen at any point in life, but there are peaks, if you will, unfortunately, in youth and an increasing risk with age. I think we've now unraveled what really may be the underpinnings of why leukemia happens, why acute myeloid leukemia happens. We're starting to be able to decode the genetic underpinnings of different cases of AML and understand which defects may be driving the leukemia. And that's really the secret, is to find out what switches have been thrown, what circuitry is active, and what's driving leukemia. One example of a pathway that's been identified is probably came from some place we didn't think to look initially, which is in the basic mechanisms of how a cell makes energy in something called the mitochondria. The name of the abnormality is something called an IDH2 mutation. And this, again, is something that many people remember from high school biology, the Krebs cycle and how a cell keeps itself going and creates energy. And an enzyme defect in the pathway in mitochondria can cause the DNA in blood cells to change. And we've actually exploited that and developed a drug that blocks mutations in something called IDH1 and IDH2. And some data from ASH showed very encouraging results from now an oral targeted drug with very low side effects that can be used to treat patients with acute leukemia, which often requires conventionally strong chemotherapy or conventional chemotherapy, can now be treated with the targeted therapy. Patients who were either older and hadn't responded to primary treatment or younger and weren't eligible for standard types of treatment. Overall, in a early study, a phase 1-2 study, upwards of 40% of patients responded to this oral, well-tolerated drug. Many patients had stable disease, meaning their leukemia no longer progressed, no longer proliferated, which is only part of the way towards remission. But a fraction of patients, about 1 in 5 patients, was able to get a complete remission. So we are able to get even, it may not be the majority, but at least a minority of patients with very low-risk therapies and very smart therapies into remission when other therapies have failed. Similar results were shown for a drug that targets the IDH1 mutation with slightly lower rates of complete remission, but similar overall response rates of about 30 to 40%. These drugs will continue in further studies. We maybe need to combine them with some of our available drugs and our available chemotherapy, but I think that was very important. Continuing the theme of targeted therapy, a very important trial that was presented at ASH told us that we probably ought to not just use our older chemotherapies alone, but we probably ought to add a targeted drug when we know there's a target available. It was a very large study that ran for many years, presented by Dr. Stone in AML, using the drug midostaurin, which is a targeted drug against probably multiple different pathways or defects we know may keep AML cells alive. In particular, something called a FLT3 mutation we know causes patients with leukemia to have higher blood counts and often be more resistant to chemotherapy or have more risk of relapse. So when that pathway is activated, in adding an oral well-tolerated drug, this drug midostaurin, to our backbone of standard chemotherapy, we saw some dramatic results. It took a long time to prove this trial because we needed to show, and then as Dr. O'Connor mentioned, we needed help of patients to be willing to undergo a coin toss and take a placebo versus a targeted drug, again, with the backbone of standard therapy. So no one got anything less than what we think is our best therapy, but some of the patients got this targeted drug. And in the end, we were able to show an improvement in overall survival, and the difference was dramatic between the two arms. At 4 years, there was an improvement in the number of patients who were able to stay alive and free of their leukemia, and the drug really is now being considered to be included as a standard therapy when patients have this abnormality. The same class of drugs were looked at in patients, particularly of older age, and that is an important question because sometimes the more risky chemotherapies can be even more dangerous. And in a study of a drug called sorafenib in older AML, we were able to see that the survival was almost double at 1 year for patients who, again, with the defect, were able to take that medication. Lastly, that same class of medications was also shown to benefit patients after bone marrow transplant. Another study with the drug sorafenib showed that the survival without leukemia and the overall survival at 2 years was statistically significant by an increase of about 30%. And patients were able to take advantage of that oral drug now in the post-transplant setting. So targeted therapy really is becoming an integral part of therapy for AML. Let me close with a few words on some other diseases. In ALL, or acute lymphoblastic or lymphocytic leukemia, a very important study was presented showing us that one of those earlier targeted drugs called rituximab, which is an antibody against something on the B cells that caused multiple different kinds of cancers, not only ALL but lymphoma and CLL, really should also be now included in with our chemotherapy. A large study run based in Germany, again, took many patients and a long time to complete, but the addition of rituximab to chemotherapy for patients with ALL was shown to not boost the response rate, but definitely decrease the relapse rate, and that's very important. In the end, the overall survival and outcome was good for all the patients on the trial. When patients didn't go to bone marrow transplant, though, the improvement really showed it was shining through, and that decrease in relapse, again, led people to make the statement that we should really think of that as a standard part of most people's treatment for ALL. There's been a lot of exciting data, and many of my colleagues may want to or might mention an update on CAR T cells. One of my colleagues from Memorial Sloan Kettering, Dr. Jay Park, gave a long-term follow-up from one of the projects out there looking at CAR T cell therapy and ALL. We were able to show that patients who don't always proceed to bone marrow transplant, who in this setting had lymphoid leukemias that had no other treatment options and may have had a high volume or at least a significant amount of residual leukemia, were able to, at a high rate, 80 to 90% of those respond to this engineered T-cell therapy where the T-cells are taken from a patient, modified, given back to them, and now they're much more powerful and able to fight the leukemia and very quickly put patients into what could be a complete and lasting remission. So further exciting follow-up to come with CAR T-cell therapy. And lastly, just to mention that CAR T-cell therapy is a bit specific to the patient, that it takes their own cells to be harvested and engineered. There was a small report from the ability to essentially take CAR T cells, if you will, off the shelf, as they say, and by modifying them in a way where they won't be rejected by the immune system, and they can be protected from certain drugs which would help fight the cancer, they can persist and be used in the setting of acute leukemia that hasn't responded to previous therapy, and a young child actually benefited from this new type of CAR T-cell therapy, so stay tuned for that. I'll close with what may be my favorite disease, which was CML, and mention two things. First, that if we have now three generations of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or oral drugs in CML, the first being imatinib, second being nilotinib, dasatinib, and bosutinib, and the third generation being ponatinib, we now have a drug called ABL-001. Which works by a slightly different mechanism, blocks the BCR-ABL kinase in a slightly different way. It was developed for this exact situation where mutations and resistance may develop, and essentially the lock is jammed and no key now will fit. And this oral drug in a phase 1 study is shown to be active and safe to deliver in patients with resistant CML, And we're already seeing that we didn't come up with a limiting dose, meaning the side effects were not a problem at any of the doses tested. The side effects were mild, much like the other TKIs in this class. And we're able to see that a majority of patients are either sustaining or improving their remissions, getting into deeper molecular remissions, much like some of the early data we saw with Gleevec and other drugs, putting patients who had lost remission or had no remission from their prior therapy back into remission. So as that study continues and has moved into what we call phase two, I think we may now see yet another tool for us in chronic myeloid leukemia to put patients in remission when they have selective resistance or combination of resistance or intolerance. And in particular, that drug may be useful as a combination. There was a trial stating that what's old may be new again, and we may be able to go back to the drug called interferon in combination with TKIs. A study from the French group showed that combining Sprycel or dasatinib with interferon can probably boost the rates of molecular remission without much side effect addition in patients with newly diagnosed chronic phase CML. So as we think about what's our absolute best strategy for patients with this now highly treatable and potentially curable disease, we may be able to do even better by using an older drug, which, if given right, can be safe and well-tolerated, and that is pegylated interferon in combination with dasatinib. To close, I just want to comment on the fact that what you should ask your healthcare team about. And, of course, the healthcare team is probably the first place to stop, and that should include a number of people, not just the doctor, but the nurse, maybe the research nurse. Those are key members of the team, and they can often be excellent resources for questions, for channeling information to the doctor, or have the information flow back and forth. My advice to everyone would be to ask your healthcare team about what your options are, not to be shy, to ask about research, to ask about clinical trials, as Owen emphasized. In 2016, I think it's probably important to say, is there any way to better classify my cancer? Is there any testing that can be done to fine-tune what you know about it, to understand, you know, what makes it tick, because there are increasingly diagnostics available, even in the community, even in remote areas where tumors can be sent and better classified to wake us up to the fact that other drugs really may be useful. And also, I encourage people to never be shy about seeking a second opinion. A good doctor and a good cancer specialist will never be insulted or feel bad or be reticent about someone seeking a second opinion. It's often reassuring for me if someone does that. It's very good to often hear that sometimes the same thoughts are passed on, and the patient now has that double level of confidence, or maybe something new that someone had missed is revealed, and a patient can do better, and that's good for everyone. So never be shy about a second opinion. So let me close there, and thank you all for your attention.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Morrow. That was really wonderful, really excellent, and very lots of information, and there'll be lots of questions for you as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Ruben Mesa. Dr. Mesa is consultant hematologist, Mayo Clinic in Arizona, chair, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, deputy director, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, professor of medicine. And Dr. Mesa is going to address overview of myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPN, MPN treatment and research updates from ASH, and discussing your treatment options with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to introduce a doctor, to bring to you Dr. Mesa.
Myeloproliferative neoplasms are a group of chronic leukemias, which include myelofibrosis, polycythemia vera, and essential thrombocythemia. As we look at the updates from this year's American Society of Hematology meeting, we recognize that these diseases, they are interrelated, and we assess patients in a variety of ways when both understanding the disease as well as coming up with a treatment plan. We try to assess the burden of the disease. Is it giving symptoms? Are there risks of blood clots or injury from where the blood counts are at? What is the risk an individual faces of the disease progressing to a more serious form of leukemia? As well as how do we best meet their care needs? The American Society of Hematology is the primary global hematology meeting for scientists, clinicians, those who perform clinical trials, to gather in one spot and focus on each of the different blood diseases. In MPNs, this is really our key venue each year. There were several key updates from this year's event that I would like to highlight. The first are really scientific, meaning focusing on why do patients with MPNs develop the disease? How do we better assess their risk? There continues to be a stride toward better understanding the changes in our genes in each of your cells or of the blood cells that are afflicted that can lead to the disease and what it tells us about the disease. Indeed, as we look at how MPNs afflict patients who have these diseases, we know that it's quite variable in terms of their risk. At this year's meeting, there was a better understanding of additional mutations and how they impact prognosis. We have known since 2005 about several common genetic mutations, the JAK2 V617F, calreticulin, MPL, as, let's say, the most common types of mutations. There are now up to 40 to 50 additional types of mutations that physicians can typically obtain in the United States on less common genes that can be afflicted. At this year's American Society of Hematology, there are implications regarding these other genetic changes that have impact regarding our understanding of risk. They may have impact regarding the planning around bone marrow transplantation, and they have implications in terms of long-term management of the disease. Another way we've tried to improve the individualization of medicine is better understanding the variable symptom profile that patients can face. At this year's meeting, our group, working along with the MPN Quality of Life International Study Group, had several different scientific results which we shared. One, it's very clear that MPN patients have a very distinct and difficult symptoms compared to the general population. That was done in a study along with our colleagues from Ireland. Second, we were able to look at data that we've obtained to realize certain factors that contribute to worsening symptoms. These can be patients with myelofibrosis who have low platelet counts tend to have more difficult symptoms. We identified that how long an individual has had an MPN can be correlated with worsening symptoms. We also reported that having an MPN can afflict not only quality of life, but also issues of employment. There were many updates that were very relevant regarding treatment. First, let me start with the disease of polycythemia vera. In polycythemia vera, there was update on the long-term study of ruxolitinib for patients with PVERA who had previously failed hydroxyurea. This trial, called the RESPONSE trial, showed that ruxolitinib was better than best alternative therapy for control of the hematocrit for PVERA patients, for leading to complete responses. It showed that these benefits were durable or long-lasting. It showed the ability to get free or independent of phlebotomies, as well as marked improvement in symptoms and blood counts. There also appears to be reduction in the risk of blood clotting events. In parallel with this, there's additional efforts to try to better understand the role of interferons. Two long-acting interferons, pegylated interferon alpha 2A and 2B, are currently in phase 3 trials trying to see whether patients with PVERA should begin with interferon or hydroxyurea as their initial treatment. In essential thrombocythemia, there were updates on a long-acting anagrelide formulation which is being tested. There were updates on a therapy with imetelstat, a telomerase inhibitor, and its impact on impacting genetic mutations in ET. In myelofibrosis, I would say that there were several key updates, as this remains a key area of clinical trial for improving outcomes for patients. The first, long-term benefits from ruxolitinib, with almost 5 years of follow-up, show very durable improvements in spleen response, stable blood counts, improved survival, and improved bone marrow fibrosis, presented by my colleague Claire Harrison. There were trials that have been reported that helped to demonstrate the activity of the new JAK inhibitors. PERSIST-1, with pacritinib, a JAK2 and FLT3 inhibitor, helped to demonstrate that even in patients with very severely low platelet counts, they were able to receive full dose of pacritinib and have improvements in spleen and symptoms in patients with myelofibrosis. And as we looked at different subgroups, it was independent of the different groups we looked at. There is also the ability to improve anemia or a low platelet count. Momelotinib is the other JAK2 inhibitor well along in development, currently undergoing clinical trials compared to ruxolitinib in patients with anemia with the hope of improving anemia as well as splenomegaly and symptoms for these patients. At this year's ASH, many different combination studies were reported of ruxolitinib with up to 7 different agents, each combination just being ruxolitinib with one of these. At the moment, a few of these seem promising, including combinations with danazol to improve anemia, pegylated interferon alpha-2A for those who have been previously resistant to interferon, those with 5-azacitidine to try to decrease increase blasts, as well as with panobinostat to have a further deep impact on the disease. These combination studies are ongoing. Finally, I would conclude that there are several important drugs in development, including imetelstat, which has shown in early studies to have an impact on improving spleen and symptoms, but as well as molecular mutations. This is a telomerase inhibitor currently in clinical trials. Second, an anti-fibrosing drug called PRM-151 that helps to decrease fibrosis symptom burden as well as spleen and improve low blood counts. So it's a very exciting time for new options for myeloproliferative neoplasms. It's very important as you discuss with your healthcare team where you stand with your disease to see how your therapy is working for you. Is it achieving everything that wishes to be achieved? Many of these drugs are exciting in clinical trials. Many of them are primarily for individuals who are not having an excellent response to their current treatment. So clearly, whether your current therapy is appropriate, whether there should be a change, whether a clinical trial would be worthwhile, is a discussion along with you yourself and your healthcare team. Again, I would like to thank Cancer Care for the ability to participate in today's call, and we'll hand the call back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Messer, for an excellent presentation, very informative, and there'll be lots of questions for you as well. And our next presenter is Dr. Nupur Rajay. Dr. Jay is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Rajay is going to present an overview of multiple myeloma, multiple myeloma-specific treatment and research updates from ASH, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Rajay.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It is really a pleasure to be on this call today, and thank you all for joining us today. What I will do over the next several minutes is focus on all the advances that were presented at the recently concluded ASH meeting on multiple myeloma. And I do, you know, what you will hear is a theme where you've heard about the lymphomas, the MPDs, and leukemias, but the general theme is we've moved away from chemotherapy and we're embracing more of the targeted approaches, more of the monoclonal antibodies and the immuno-oncology drugs, and this is true for all of the cancers, as is true for myeloma. For multiple myeloma, it's specifically very, very exciting because in the late last year, we had 3 new drugs approved and 1 drug approved earlier, and I do want to underscore what Dr. Owen first mentioned. The fact is all of this is possible because of participation in clinical trials by all of you patients and the caregivers who help support patients who are able to participate in these trials. We're not able to get these drugs to the broader community and get these drug approvals without really doing ongoing, all of these clinical trials, which I'm going to highlight a few of. So as is become the case every year with ASH now, this year's ASH was no different for myeloma. It had a lot of exciting data, and there was new information that was presented, which is really quite important, I do believe, for both patients and caregivers to understand, to appreciate, and at least know about so that they can go back to their healthcare teams and talk to their teams about whether or not some of these approaches are applicable to them, because as one of the speakers earlier on pointed out, these drugs are now changing the natural history of our diseases, and patients with multiple myeloma are certainly living a lot longer. What we did see at this ASH, and I think some of the important highlights here, was first I'm going to focus on the newly diagnosed patient with multiple myeloma, and there were a couple of studies which were presented here, one in the context of combination therapies in newly diagnosed myeloma, and the second one in the context of autologous transplantation in newly diagnosed patients. So SWOG, which is the Southwestern Oncology Group, presented a 500-plus patient study wherein we what was compared here.